From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the Bayshore Town Center in Glendale has continued to evolve with shopping trends, but the mall was hit hard by the Great Recession and other economic factors.
Amazon and other online retailers kept growing and growing and growing. And as a result, at this point, Bayshore has a pretty high vacancy rate, about one quarter vacant.
Then automotive contributor Mark Savage explains why the classic sedan is becoming more popular.
You can get a nice sedan for $25,000. These are things that are loaded and comfortable and easy to get a family of four, maybe five in, depending on the size. And hey, it's a bargain out there. And most of them get really good gas mileage also.
Bubbler Talk visits some fallout shelters, and we'll have the August Milwaukee Music Roundup with Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Shopping malls in the United States are facing an uphill battle. As online sales have boomed over the past decade, traditional brick-and-mortar stores have seen declining profits despite rising rents. But in many ways, this is just the latest chapter of evolving consumer habits and trends. And perhaps there's no better example of this progression than Bayshore Town Center in Glendale. Tom Dakin is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he wrote about the latest development at Bayshore. He speaks with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and starts by explaining how the mall has changed since it was first built in 1954.
It was an outdoor strip center. Back when shopping centers were being built, that's how we did them. You'd have something like Kmart or maybe Penny's as an anchor, and all the storefronts faced outside. Then it got converted into an indoor shopping mall, much like we built in the 60s and 70s. If you think of places like Brookfield Square, Southridge, Bayshore became that in the mid-70s. And then about a little over a decade ago, it was transformed again, this time into a town center. And with a town center, what you did is they kept the old portion of the mall, but then they built all these additional buildings that had an internal kind of traditional street grid, much like you'd see in a downtown area within the mall itself. And you had sidewalks, and you had ways to encourage people to walk around once they got to the property. They built parking ramps, which were new for that area, and in order to allow for more development because, you know, you need less land for parking when you go from surface lots to parking ramps. So that all happened in about 2006. The city of Glendale put up quite a bit of money to help make this happen, spent the money up front through a tax incremental financing district, through the expectation that then the new property tax revenue generated by the town center would repay that debt over roughly 20, 25 years. And then once that's done, you have all this new property tax base for your community, for your school district, et cetera. Well, unfortunately, within about 2 years, we're in the middle of the worst recession since the Great Depression. And then on top of that, Amazon and other online retailers kept growing and growing and growing. And as a result, at this point, Bayshore has a pretty high vacancy rate, about one quarter vacant. They had some major anchors, Sears, Boston store close. And as a result, the value of Bayshore declined considerably. So it's no longer providing the same level of property tax revenue to pay down the city's debt. The ownership of Bayshore went from Mall Properties Incorporated out of New York to the lender to the development, American International Group, AIG, also out of New York, very large financial services provider. Essentially, it was a deed in lieu of foreclosure. I mean, basically, the owner tossed the keys to the lender and said, here, take it. It's yours now. We can't pay the debt. We're not going to pay the debt any longer. So AIG at that point had a decision to make. The entity, the small investors group that controlled the property that AIG now owned, that entity could have declared bankruptcy. And that would have been a very, very bad thing for the city of Glendale. I wouldn't be surprised if that would have resulted perhaps in the city itself declaring bankruptcy, because the city would have been saddled with no means of collecting that large debt. And, you know, as a city, you still have to pay your firefighters, your police officers, your sanitation workers, et cetera. Luckily, AIG saw some value in that property. And instead, through a series of negotiations between AIG and the city, there was an agreement created, which has just now been approved by the Common Council and the mayor in Glendale. And that agreement essentially said AIG agrees to wipe off the city's remaining debt. $57 million, wipe the slate clean. But in return, what AIG wanted was the city to help them finance now this latest reincarnation of Bayshore. This time around, the city is going to finance only if the improvements are made. So instead of the city spending, say, $30 million up front, the city spends that money in stages, again, through the new property tax revenue generated by these by this latest series of improvements. So the city is mitigating its risk considerably this time around. And in return, AIG is taking that money plus money it has and money it's borrowing from PIMCO, which is a very large investment manager out of Southern California. And they are going to tear down the old mall. They're going to relocate the few tenants left in that old mall into current vacancies in some of the newer buildings they built. And then they're going to make some of those newer buildings look better. They're really going to pay attention to these sort of public gathering places at Bayshore. So if you're familiar with the Rotunda area near what used to be the movie theater there, they're going to make that better. They're going to actually put in escalators, which surprisingly they don't have. They are going to improve the public square. That sunken fountain that's been there is gone, which is probably a good thing because what that effectively meant is during the winter months, the public square was inoperable. Now it's going to be open year-round. They're going to green it up. They're going to put in a big LED screen, kind of like what you have at the plaza over here at the Fiserv Forum. And the whole idea is to make it look better, make it a place where people want to be, where people want to gather, make it more pedestrian-friendly for people to circulate throughout the area. And then in addition to that, they will sell off parcels that are created through the demolition of the old mall, the partial demolition of Boston Store's old building, and then you still have the parcel left over from where the former Sears is torn down. And the idea is they'll sell off those parcels to other people, other companies who will develop, will probably get apartments there. I think that's probably going to be the greatest demand for new use there. We might even get a hotel as a possibility. So it's really now truly going to become a mixed-use development. When all is said and done, it's going to be quite a bit different than what it is now.
You know, you talked about a lot of the history of the Bayshore Mall there. And like I would guess the vast majority of malls in the country right now, it's gone through a lot of different changes, in part because the way we shop has evolved,
right.
The things we're looking for in those places has evolved. How does this redevelopment compare to other things we've seen, specifically in the Milwaukee area?
Well, we just mentioned a couple of them, and you know, Whitestone Station in Menominee Falls is something like that, where you have that mix of uses, and the retailers there are retailers that are driven not so much by like high-end fashion, but just like everyday type necessity. Like the big anchor, what made Whitestone Station work initially was Costco. Costco's a very large—I mean, you know what they're like, very large footprint. They sell everything under the sun. In the case of 84 South, it was largely driven, I think, by Steinhoffel wanting to have a new upgraded store, but also Kohl's wanted to be in there. Kohl's wanted out of Southridge Mall. Kohl's likes to be in standalone locations, so that helped drive that. Now, the Corners is kind of the exception. The Corners was driven by Von Maur, which is higher up the fashion chain for your listeners who are familiar with that. So it's not always the case. But and in all these places, you're also getting retail that's not stores, but more like restaurants, a lot of dining components to these places, a lot of entertainment components to some of these places. And that's what's helping drive the revival of some of the suburban shopping malls. Brookfield Square, you probably know, they're about to get Whirly Ball in there. They're about to get a Marcus Theater and Restaurant Complex. There's a Marcus Theater Restaurant Complex now at Southridge, which also has kind of a game-oriented entertainment center there as well. And again, that's a reflection of what you were just talking about. People are spending less money buying things, but they still like to do things. And that's a big part, again, of what's driving Bayshore. I think what we're going to see at Bayshore is probably a lot of those vacant spaces are going to be filled by food and beverage type businesses. The one big news store we know is going in there is Total Wine & More. They're going to take the old Sports Authority building. So that we do know. But I think a lot of these are going to be food and beverage and more entertainment-oriented type businesses as opposed to places selling stuff.
I will say when I go to Bayshore Mall, which I do actually with some frequency, I specifically go there for Trader Joe's.
Oh, yeah. That was a big win for them. I mean, and a store like Trader Joe's, think of how often you go to supermarkets. They drive a lot of repeat business. I mean, I don't know how often you go shopping for clothes, but you probably, I'm almost sure you go shopping for food a lot more often than you go shopping for dresses, skirts, pants, you know, accessories, et cetera, right? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've been talking about how shopping trends have really changed over time. And we look at certain malls that are still doing well despite the fact that shopping trends have changed. I'm specifically thinking of Mayfair Mall over in Wauwatosa. What are they doing differently? Are they doing anything differently?
Well, number one, Mayfair Mall is lucky. Maybe, okay, let me back up. Their managers are very good, but it also helps to be lucky. It helps to be located smack dab in the geographic center of the Milwaukee metropolitan area. When you're on Mayfair Road at that location, you're roughly equal distance to a lot of different communities that have a fair number of middle and upper middle class households. That's a great location for them to be. But in addition to that, in part because of that, but also because, you know, people running are good at what they do, they've drawn some good anchor retailers. I mean, the big win for them was Nordstrom. I mean, Nordstrom is a legit type retailer that will actually draw other retailers to your mall. You can't say that about everyone, but you can definitely say it about Nordstrom. Other retailers will want to, as they say, co-locate if there's a Nordstrom at your mall. So that helped because, look, they got Container Store now. That's a big part of what helps them. And, you know, they've done a good job of getting dining options. And then right now, more recently, they have very wisely opted to redevelop that building on their perimeter, the old office building, into what's going to be a very, very nice high-end hotel. Now, they're doing that in partnership with the developer that's coming in. Kyle Striggins and his partners are doing that. HKS Development is the name of the company. But it's going to be, a gorgeous Marriott Renaissance hotel, the only one of its kind in our area, chef-driven restaurant, rooftop, meeting room, et cetera. You know, that can't help but help your mall, right, when you get something like that on the perimeter. So, yeah, and should toss in, the city has helped out. The city helped make that happen with some TIF financing. And the city, the Common Council, and the mayor there made it quite clear that they didn't like the first plan, which was to tear down the building and put up some kind of middle-tier type restaurants. They said, hey, we can do better than this, and we will help you with the TIF district to do better than this. And so, voila, now you've got a gorgeous hotel going in there that's going to add more value to the property.
When I look at Mayfair especially, you know, you mentioned the dining options, and something that sticks out to me when I compare it to other similar malls, similar insular malls, is a lot of those dining options are actually accessible from outside of the mall. They are more permeable. How important is that in the design of more modern malls?
Well, it's very important. I mean, first of all, it gives those restaurants a ton of visibility. You could drive by a mall, it could have a great restaurant, and you wouldn't know it's there. We see that other properties. Brookfield Square is a good example, where you have a lot of restaurants that in the past decade or so have been built on the periphery. And it's interesting, if you go to Brookfield Square, it can be a little dead inside the actual mall itself, but there can be a lot of activity just on the outside at all those different restaurants on the periphery. And I'm sure Whirly Ball and the Marcus Cinema will have a lot of that activity as well.
When we look at the redevelopment of many of these malls and even urban malls, what do we see as the future of how we design these spaces?
I think a big thing that developers and mall operators have a better appreciation for that they didn't have even 10 years ago is public space. And you really see that vividly illustrated with Bayshore. Bayshore, yeah, they built the little town center, but that was really about it. The rotunda area indoor kind of. When I was at a presentation this week, Kirk Williams, the gentleman with Cypress Equities, and that's the Dallas space firm that AIG has hired to basically do this project because Cypress, that's what they do. They do development. Kirk put up a slide at this presentation and said, what do you see there? What don't you see there? And what you don't see there is green space. And that, he said, if you were starting over today and doing this, you wouldn't do it that way. You would definitely carve out more public space because, yeah, you don't make money per se on public space. You're not renting it to a retailer, but you're improving the value of your property because people want to be there. I mean, that's the important thing. Look what's happening right now with the former Grand Avenue. I literally walked past on my way over here for this interview. At the corner of Wisconsin Avenue and Old World 3rd Street, what used to be the main entrance of the Grand Avenue. We all know what used to be there, right? The giant glass aquarium that was built, ironically, not built when it was originally opened. When it originally opened in 1982, it had a much more graceful, kind of meets the street appropriately type entrance. But in 2000, 2001, that was during a period when all the rage was to build these ridiculous big glass boxes, as if to say to your potential patrons, I don't know, come on and get trapped inside. I don't know what they were thinking. But at any rate, I suppose it's to make some kind of visual mark. Well, it made a visual mark. It looked horrendous. It'd be like, you know, you put a scar on your face and say, hey, notice me. So what's happening now is the glass box is gone. We're going to create a much more gradual sweep from the street up to the main entrance, which was there, ironically, again, when it first opened. We've removed part of the old Applebee's restaurant. We're going to create a much more appropriately scaled entrance. And we're going to create a public square there. We're going to literally have public space there. It's going to blend into the beer garden that's going to be part of the food hall, Third Street Market Hall, which is going to be sort of the signature development at the Avenue. So, I mean, there'll be some of that space will be for patrons of the beer hall, but it will kind of blend into the public space. And if you want to go and sit in that public space all day and hang out, you're not only free to do so, you'd probably be encouraged to do so because, again, they want people to feel welcome. If you feel welcome there, usually you're going to end up spending money there as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that developers really have a better appreciation for now than they had in prior mall building periods.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Tom Dakin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Tom Dakin reports on commercial real estate for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can hear more of our conversations with Dakin about development in the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take another break, and then our automotive contributors join us to praise the sedan. Lake Effect Weekend continues in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Trucks and SUVs and crossovers. Oh my, what is a poor sedan to do? Well, there was a time when sedans were kings of the road. If you needed more cargo room, you just bought a station wagon. But those days are long gone. Trucks, SUVs, and crossovers have reigned supreme basically since the gas shortages of the 1970s. But sedans have been quietly doing their own thing this whole time, getting us from point A to point B without any fanfare, except the occasional headline. And while there are fewer sedan choices these days, the remaining ones have had to up their game to stay competitive. Automotive contributors Dan Harmon and Mark Savage joined Lake Effect to discuss where sedans fit in the current marketplace.
Something that I've noticed is as the Chryslers and Fords in particular and GM to a certain degree have decided to cut back on their sedans, that as I've gone through car shows and various events in the last 6 months, everybody else is talking up sedans. So I just think it's kind of funny. I mean, I guess sedans make up about 25% of the marketplace right now and cars overall about 30% of the marketplace. So that's 5 to 6 million vehicles out there that are being sold. And, you know, if you start chopping out two or three of those makes, that leaves, let's say, 240, 250,000, maybe more, maybe 300,000 sales for the other car makers. So it's not too surprising to see in my mind, the Nissans and the Volkswagens kind of step forward and say, hey, we're going to keep doing sedans and get some of that market share.
And when you said you heard the mall talking up sedans, are they talking them up because there's going to be a return of sedans, or they're just talking it up because they're talking about their new models of sedan?
Well, I'm sure of both. But Nissan was generous enough to share some of their survey information with us. And you know, I don't know how many people they surveyed, but nonetheless, they were happy with this. And if they're churning their business this way. I got a feeling they're pretty strong on this. But they said 78% of non-sedan buyers that they had surveyed would consider buying one for their next car. And 86% of millennials, which obviously is a growing part of the market right now, would consider it. And 8 of 10 of the millennials that are single parents said that sedans were on their shopping list. And it just makes sense in that sedans, generally speaking, at least for now, are a good bargain because it used to be little pickup trucks were the bargain, and now those cost $40,000 and $50,000, as do the bigger trucks, $50,000 and $60,000. And crossovers are kind of in between there a little bit. But you can get a nice sedan for $25,000, and if you want a really nice one, to $45,000. So these are things that are loaded and comfortable and easy to get a family of four, maybe five in, depending on the size. And, hey, it's a bargain out there. And most of them get really good gas mileage also.
Now, what's occurred to me about sedans is that as they become less a part of the market or already have, that the ones that are left are going to have to be better. So in some ways, there are less sedans, there are fewer of them, but they're getting better.
Right, and that's what you're seeing right now with the Volkswagen. I just drove the Arteon, and with Nissan, I've driven the Altima and the Maxima, and I think the Sentra earlier this year too. And they're all quieter than they used to be. They've put some more sound deadening into these, so that they seem, you know, maybe a little more luxurious, even if that's not what you would consider the car to be. And they handle well, and most of them have, you know, a reasonable amount of power. Some have the turbo engines now because turbos, of course, have become so popular to increase, you know, the power ratings for all the cars. And almost everything now has all the safety equipment that, you know, when you and I were talking maybe 3 and 4 years ago, it was brand new that they had backup cameras and lane departure warnings and assists. And in fact, a number of the cars now have this thing that if you engage cruise control, it helps steer the car while you're driving in cruise control. And so you know, get near a line on the road and it starts to push the car back into the middle. And that's just automatic these days. So when you can get that on a, let's say, $30,000 to $35,000 sedan, why should I pay $35,000 to $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 for something bigger and heavier and maybe less efficient? And I'm just as safe, if not safer, as long as I don't run into a truck.
And how much of this, I guess I'm going to call it re-interest or new interest in sedans, is economics? And how much of it is perhaps a rejection of trucks or a rejection of SUVs or a rejection of crossovers?
I don't think so much would be the rejection of the crossovers and the trucks. I'm sure, you know, a few people may go that route. But I really think it's going to be driven by economics because the trucks that used to be economical are no longer economical. So you want to, you know, if you're a single parent with one or two kids, or if you're, you know, a young family and you're looking for, you know, inexpensive wheels, but you want the safety devices on your car and you want it to be a nice, you know, comfortable car to take a trip in, man, the sedans are just, you know, they're screaming at you to say, look at my price tag, because that's so much less. I mean, the average price of a new car, they say, is $36,000 and a truck is $46,000. That's a big difference just if you're getting the average car, and that's, you know, meaning I'm not getting the base one. So the base models are anywhere from $22,000 to $28,000 now, and while that's not cheap, it's a whole lot less expensive than getting a, you know, entry-level SUV or certainly a pickup truck these days.
Are you lumping hatchbacks into the sedan category? Or are they their own thing? Just because those are even cheaper than sedans, but they pretty much behave like a sedan, just as low.
And I agree with you. They are pretty much like sedans, and they don't count the same in the numbers that when they start doing all the addition for the car companies. But again, you know, maybe that's 5% of the market out there. But to you and I know that really like the hatchbacks, you know, I would probably get a hatchback over a sedan just for styling purposes, and I just love being able to flip up the hatch and toss as much as I want in the back. But again, sedans or hatchbacks certainly are both in the same category for the same kind of pricing and, you know, same kind of value.
I guess I'm curious as to what automakers are doing to entice people into buying sedans, or is that not how they're viewing it?
I don't think all the automakers are doing that, because obviously if you were starting to phase these out over the – actually, I think by the end of this model year, most of these will be phased out by Ford and Chrysler outside of – I think they got the Charger and the Mustang. But I think what you're going to see is that marketing efforts will probably pick up by some of the car makers. Like I say, Nissan tells us they're trying to redo their whole lineup basically in the next year or two. And when they had a new Sentra, Altima, and Maxima, and Versa last year and this year, or 19 and 20, you know, you're going to see them pushing those a lot harder than they had been in the past. And Volkswagen's got a new Passat, and the Jetta is fairly new, and the Arteon. So you're going to see those. Just off the top of my head here, I think Subaru has a new WRX. The Legacy was new about a year ago. Hyundai has an Elantra. So you're seeing remakes of cars that have been out there for a while, but they'll have more and more of this the safety equipment on it. And again, they haven't jacked the prices way up on these things yet, because I'm assuming they feel that they can't get that. But as soon as people start buying them, then the price will start going up. So I'm just saying, this is be a market leader, go for one of these now, and get a good price and get a nice car. And the other thing that we had mentioned before the show here was that only a few cars, sedans, actually increased in sales last year, but they were substantial, and that was the Camry and the Honda Civic and the Nissan Sentra. So those were all up. Those are all top six cars in the selling of around the country. In fact, Camry's been number one for quite a while now. So if those are gaining popularity, I think that's a good overall sign that if you keep your cars current and keep them up to date with all the safety technology, that people are happy to buy them and save a little money and probably save a little on gas and so forth down the road.
Yeah, I think there's always going to be a certain percentage of the population that will just want a sedan or a coupe, no matter what.
Right, and we've talked before about the SUVs and the crossovers, and part of the appeal of those is that they sit a little higher, and many of them have all-wheel drive. So in our climate, for instance, an all-wheel drive car is going to sell maybe a little bit better than a non-all-wheel drive car. But I wouldn't be surprised to see more and more of the cars coming out with all-wheel drive, and Subaru obviously for years has been doing all-wheel drive, so they already got that figured out.
You listed a few, the Charger, Mustang, WRX, and while not all of these are sedans, they're certainly well into the sedan slash coupe category. I'm wondering how many are niche cars and how many of the sedans that are left are just, sedan versus some kind of something that makes it appealing, like the WRX is a performance sedan, or the Charger is kind of performance slash nostalgia. Same thing with the Mustang. Does there have to be some kind of catch with these to get them to sell?
No, and I think that's the funny part, is that for the Ford and the Chrysler, it really is that nostalgia, retro name and look, and somewhat the same for the Camaro, obviously, for Chevy. But when I look down the list of the top 12 cars from this last year, all of them are just normal everyday vehicles that you would think, your neighbor has or you have. And, just a quick rundown. We got Camry, Civic, Corolla, Accord, Altima, Sentra, Hyundai Elantra, and then the Fusion Cruise and Focus, but they're being phased out. Malibu is in there, and Chevy is keeping that, and the Kia Forte. And then there's another 8 or 10 right after that that are all normal cars that, they have been fairly current. And Optima now has a hybrid. I know that. These are all nice cars that do the job to get you to and from work and wherever you need to go. And I don't know if there's an image that crossovers and SUVs have still. Is that, do you still think of it as a sport utility vehicle? Is it sporty? Is it, what's making it sporty? I don't get that. So they're trucks with four-wheel drive or all-wheel drive, and that's nice, and that helps in certain climates.
All right. All right, Mark. I'm glad we talked about sedans. I think they're not getting enough attention for sure.
I think they're not either. And like I say, everybody should always be looking what's not the most popular thing at the moment, because I bet that's a pretty good value.
Okay. Thanks, Mark.
Okay. Thank you.
You'll find Mark Savage's latest auto review on the Nissan Leaf at WUWM.com and on his website, SavageOnWheels.com. Savage is also editor of Scale Auto Magazine, part of Kalmbach Publishing in Waukesha. He joins contributor Dan Harmon regularly to talk about cars, and you can explore their past segments at WUWM.com. We will take another break, and then Bubbler Talk visits some fallout shelters. Lake Effect Weekend continues with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM reporter Chuck Kornbach answering this question.
Do these shelters really have functionality?
Whitefish Bay resident Tom Fearing means the fallout shelters built 50 or 60 years ago. That post-World War II era, of course, was filled with tension over nuclear weapons. In 1945, the U.S. largely ended the war in the Pacific by dropping two atomic bombs on Japan. Then the Soviet Union exploded its first atomic bomb in 1949, and the nuclear arms race took off. Bomb testing continued for decades, including this 1953 explosion in the Nevada desert. Hollywood picked up on the nuclear threat with several dramatic films, but by 1964, director Stanley Kubrick made a parody. Here's actor Slim Pickens playing an Air Force pilot in a trailer from Kubrick's film, Dr. Strangelove.
Well, boys, I reckon this is it. Nuclear combat toe-to-toe with the Ruskies.
But even that movie had a serious ending. For civilians, the Federal Civil Defense Administration recommended several steps, including homeowners and communities building fallout shelters in basements or backyards to protect people from radiation after a nuclear explosion. Our Bubbler Talk questioner, Tom Fearing, has spotted a few Milwaukee-area buildings that still have the silver and yellow or black and yellow fallout shelter signs. There are two such signs on the outside walls of Lake Bluff Elementary School in Shorewood, and Fearing wonders if they're still relevant.
You know, you'd hate to have a situation where indeed there's an altercation going on with North Korea or Russia or something, and people indeed are looking for shelters, and if these spaces are not usable, well, we shouldn't have signs declaring them as fallout shelters.
The Shorewood School District says the shelter space in Lake Bluff Elementary has, quote, long since been converted into classroom space. The signs remain on the facade of the building as an important historical reminder to those who pass by the grounds. A few blocks away in Shorewood at St. Robert's School, which also has a fallout shelter sign on an outside wall, facilities manager Peter Sorcy let us in. Sorcy opens the door to a basement hallway about 50 feet long. He says it's a very solid structure.
It's waterproofed, and I don't know the thickness of it, but it's a very heavy-duty concrete tunnel, basically, is what it is.
Sorcy says students and staff now go into the tunnel during tornado drills or just use it as a wintertime passageway between the school and St. Robert's Church. School officials say the fallout shelter signs are still up because the federal government hasn't told the school to take them down. The Milwaukee County Office of Emergency Management says it believes there are several dozen buildings in the area that still have the signs. The county says it's hard to say how many of the shelters are still functional. Another one that isn't usable is at the former day hospital of the county's Behavioral Health Division at the Milwaukee Regional Medical Complex.
No drywall, all concrete.
During a tour of the basement, operations and facilities supervisor Greg Kurzinski marvels at the thick walls and ceilings. But he says the former hospital and a nearby kitchen building that was a shelter are possibly going to be torn down. The signs left some time ago.
When they decommissioned the building and mothballed it, fallout shelter signs, guys would take them and put them in their rec rooms, you know.
The county's emergency management office says it doesn't even focus on nuclear weapons anymore when urging citizens to prepare for disaster. Communications Director Kevin Shermack says instead the federal agency FEMA urges an all-hazards approach.
It really comes down to preparing yourself for anything. You want to build an emergency kit for your family, for the home.
Pam Richard of Peace Action Wisconsin says she's okay with fallout shelters apparently falling out of use.
I don't think you could improve them to any point that most people could survive. If you survived, you may come out to such severe radiation that you still would die when you came out of your fallout shelter.
Peace Action works for nuclear disarmament. Richard says she doubts the U.S., North Korea, and other nations with nuclear weapons are ready to give them up. So she says the key is to keep world leaders from using the devices. Chuck Kornbach, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Pottawatomie Hotel and Casino, home to 24/7 entertainment, dining, and musical acts, plus additional hotel rooms and Ember Salon and Spa, opening in August 2019. More at paysbig.com. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
We'll take one last break, and then Matt Wild from Milwaukee Record joins us with this month's Milwaukee Music Roundup. Stick around. Lake Effect Weekend continues in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Matt Wild is one of the co-founders of Milwaukee Record, which he and the other co-founder, Tyler Moss, describe as an online source for music, culture, and gentle sarcasm. Among the many cultural things Milwaukee Record keeps track of is a nearly exhaustive list of new music from local musicians. Last month, Lake Effect started a partnership with Milwaukee Record based on that monthly list called Milwaukee Music Roundup. And Matt joins me now for round two. Hey, Matt
Wild. Hey, Matt Wild, how are you?
Hello, I'm doing very well. Thank you very much.
And it's great to have you back. This is round two of our Milwaukee Music Roundup. It went so well last month, we thought we'd do it again.
Well, thank you very much. I thought I was just going to get booted out of here after 1 month.
So we thought about that. But, you know.
Yeah, the fact that you brought me back for month two, I feel really good about that. So thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. And we've got some really good, interesting tunes for this roundup. Who are you going to start with?
We do. We have kind of a strange month in Milwaukee music, kind of a bittersweet month in a lot of ways, but we'll start with a new record and new music from a band that no longer exists. The band is Solo. And Solo, for many years, I think they began around 2013, were one of the best, I thought, kind of indie rock bands in Milwaukee. They put out a string of terrific albums. And I think their last one was called Cheer Up in 2017. And not too long after that, they decided to call it quits. They moved on to different projects, moved on to different cities. I don't think any of them still live here anymore. And they were terrific, and a lot of people miss them. And then suddenly, out of the blue, this earlier this month, I think on the 1st of August, wake up one morning and it's like, hey, here's an album that we recorded that we didn't tell anyone about, and here it is. And we recorded it over the winter, and it's 12, 13 new songs. We're still not a band, but here's this album.
That was my question. Had they gotten back together? But no, they just decided to. Were they old songs that they hadn't recorded?
No, or? I guess they were a lot of new songs. I think that they, had been kicking around for a little while, but maybe were intended for, for the project to continue, but then it didn't. So they decided to release them anyway. And it was very bittersweet because it's a terrific album. The name of the album is Drinks Gasoline. And I believe the song we're going to listen to is very indicative of their stuff. Very jangly, nervy, very energetic, very twisty, turny guitar rock. The name of the song is Threesome. And it's, like I said, a very kind of bittersweet thing to hear this great band, all this new music, and knowing that, at least for the time being, we won't be able to hear them play it live. But it's great to have this new music from them.
It's very clear to me.
That was Soul Low, and we should say S-O-U-L. L-O-W,
that's
if you're looking for the back albums.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Threesome from their new and final album, Drinks Gasoline. And you're right, it's like, okay, guys, you're doing so well.
They're one of these bands that I don't think, I saw someone else say this once about them. It's, they're going to be in a band that in 5-10 years, a lot of new bands are going to cite as like an influence. A lot of new Milwaukee bands are going to say, wow, some of the first music, Milwaukee music I listened to was Solo. A lot of the first Milwaukee shows I went to were Solo. I think they're going to have a big impact on the Milwaukee music scene going forward.
Okay. Well, this next group also has an impact on the Milwaukee music scene. They've actually been in the studio next door to perform. That's Nickel and Rose.
Absolutely. Nickel and Rose have been the duo, kind of the folk country Americana duo of Hannah Rose and Carl Nichols. They've been playing since about 2016, I think, and they play out a lot. And as you said, they've been here. They're always terrific, just two terrifically talented musicians. Hannah plays the upright bass. Carl plays guitar. They both sing. They sound wonderful together. They're always busy. I think they put out an EP last year, and there was one before that. They're always touring, always playing, just terrific. And very, very, very important, very modern, of its time, protest music, especially the song that we're going to listen to is called Another Man. This is a song written by Carl and deals with police brutality. And it's based on a Vera Hall recording. It has some terrific lyrics, and it's a very, very sad song, very angry song, and a very personal song. Something that Carl does in this song, and he's done in other songs as well. You know, they're talking about something that's a national concern, and then kind of throws a curveball in the middle of the song and turns it on, you know, to be about himself. And he has lyrics in here specifically discussing, you know, his encounters with police as a young black man. And it's just an absolute knockout of a song. Absolutely terrific. Like I said, very angry, very sad protest music. And, you know, on top of all that, like I said before, both of them are such amazing musicians. And to see them and hear them play live is always a treat. And it's just a terrific song, Another Man.
Another man is dead. My grandpa was young, he had to hold his tongue, cause they'd hang you from a bridge downtown, now they call it stand your ground, another man is dead.
Nickel and Rose with Another Man. Is this from an EP or is this a single they put out?
This is just a single they put out. I'm not sure if they're working on a new EP right now. I believe they're on tour in Europe, which is something they do from time to time. They're always out and about. And I think their tour is going to finish up in Nashville in September at Americana Fest, if you happen to be in Nashville.
Cool. Well, they deserve it. They deserve it. Great people. As you said, great musicians, but also just really nice people.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's nice when that works together.
Terrific working with them, yes.
Yeah. All right. So who's next?
We have just a delightful little song. This is from a band called Ravi Lola. Now, Ravi Lola has been kicking around Milwaukee for about 5 years or so, and they're a very psychedelic band. And when I think a lot of people these days talk about psychedelic music, we think of like real heavy kind of reverb-drenched, drony music. This is not that kind of psychedelic music. It's very whimsical and very kind of kitchen sink and cute and delightful. And Ravi Lola, they've put out a couple of albums before, and they've been kind of these big, sprawling, experimental, kind of crazy albums, and I've really liked them. But their new album that they just put out, it's called Neighborhood Daydream. It's, I think, by far their strongest album yet. It's a very concise album. I don't know if you could call it a concept album necessarily, but the front man for the band, his name is Casey Seymour, he said that, you know, it's inspired by the neighborhoods of Milwaukee, of which there are many, specifically River West. And he kind of, enjoys, writing these kind of character sketches. And he's got a song on here about Mailman Mike, who a lot of folks from River West are familiar with. And another person who most of Milwaukee, I would think, would be familiar with, John Gerda. He has a song called Scholar Gerda, comma, John. And that's a song we're going to be listening to. And I'm just so tickled that someone finally wrote a song for Milwaukee's celebrity and ubiquitous historian, John Gerda. I think he even heard this song. I think there was a picture of Casey with Mr. Gerda, and he seemed delighted. So this is a terrific kind of sing-along song. It's called Scholar Gerda John.
His name is Scholar Gerda John. He knows Milwaukee like the back of his arm. His name is Scholar Gerda John. He knows Milwaukee like the back of his arm. He's written books about the various neighborhoods.
Oh yeah, oh yeah,
oh yeah. He'll teach about the Irish first major in the print.
That's Ravi Lola from their album Neighborhood Daydream with a song, Scholar Gerda, comma, John. And I have to think, is that the first time somebody's written a song about John Gerda, really?
It could be. I don't know.
Wow.
I know. You'd think there'd be entire
Many.
Albums written about the man.
Many.
But.
And that's, well, it's fantastic. And it's very hummable.
Yes.
And it's also, it's very sweet.
Mm-hmm. Much like the man himself, something a lot of people don't know about John Gerda. If you or your friends ever discuss Milwaukee history, even by yourselves, you need to get express written consent from John Gerda to talk about Milwaukee history.
Oh, has he got it?
Otherwise, he'll come after you. Yeah,
oh, okay.
That's
on his bike.
Yes.
Yes.
He is ruthless. He will...
Ruthless about that.
Absolutely.
All right. So, Matt Wild, who are we going to wrap up with this month?
We are going to wrap up with a band that itself is wrapping up, unfortunately.
Okay. What is it? You've got a band that's no longer together, and now a band like this is its swan song.
I told you. It's kind of a bittersweet month.
It's kind of sad.
So this
like
band,
the end of summer.
It is. It really is. Yeah. It couldn't be more perfectly timed. This band is called No. And their new album is called Diagnostic. And they have announced, when they announced the album, which is kind of their second full-length album, they announced that it would be their final album, that members are moving on to different projects and other life situations. And it, for me, at least, this is one of my favorite bands, and it has been since they've been kicking around since 2014 or so. And they kind of grew out of another band called the Delphines, who are also terrific. And so they've kind of been around for a long time in Milwaukee and kind of started as a shoegazy kind of Jesus and Mary Chain kind of band and have slowly evolved into a more kind of poppy synth pop group. Their last album, which they put out a couple of years ago, was absolutely terrific and contained, I think, one of the best Milwaukee singles of the past decade. It was a song called Whatever. And there are similar songs on this album, too, including the one we're going to listen to, Divination. And like I said, it's very sad to see this band go. Kind of one of the lead songwriters for the group, Harrison Colby, he also, still does run a record label called Gloss Records in Milwaukee. And for a while there, for a stretch of years, I mean, anyone who was anyone that was, putting out great music in town was putting them out on this record label, this imprint. And to kind of see No, which was kind of, the flagship band of that label, to kind of see them hang it up is, like I said, it's kind of sad. And it feels like an end of an era in a lot of ways. So it's very bittersweet for me. It's great that they're going out on a high note. This is a terrific album so far. I just have been listening to this thing over and over since I got a hold of it, and it's terrific. And it's, like I said, it's a good way to go out, but it is sad that they are going. So No, the new album is called Diagnostic, and the song we'll listen to is Divination.
To myself.
the soon-to-be-defunct No-No with Divination from their last album, Diagnostic. You're right. Whenever anyone references Scottish bands like Jesus and Mary Chain, and a little bit of Mogwai in there too, I think, as well. I love that because there's that certain sound I've always liked.
Yeah. I think Harrison and the other singer, Kat Reese, singing together, they've always been so terrific, and it's something that I've really liked about this band. And a band that's never been afraid of just writing a hooky pop song, which I always appreciate too. If anyone wants to see them live, they are playing their final show, which doubles as the record release show. That's September 21st at Mad Planet. It's a terrific bill, and that'll be a chance for everyone to say goodbye to No No and say goodbye to the summer and say goodbye to an era of Milwaukee music.
There you go. Well, Matt Wild, bring me some people who are sticking around next month,
yes,
okay?
Yes, I'll try to bring some fresh new talent, not everyone that's just leaving.
It's like, okay, we're done here. Just that's the last song ever.
That's right.
But anyway, thanks so much for coming by. Great set list this month, and we'll talk next month.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup, and we'll feature a few of them here on the show. There's a link on WUWM.com to the tunes we feature today, as well as a link to Matt's complete list on Milwaukee Record as well. And Milwaukee Music wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered. It's coming up next.